Welcome to today's Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American, read by volunteers at the Recording Library of West Texas. This production is also available at recordinglibrary.org and on the telephone reader by calling 432-617-5555.
Hello, this is Cindy reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram for Saturday, January 4th. Crude up 3.1%, closes at $63.05. Crude oil prices surged toward their highest level since a Saudi Arabian oil processing facility was attacked this past September in the aftermath of a U.S. airstrike in Iraq that killed a top Iranian general Thursday night, heightening geopolitical risks. After gaining as much as 4.8% Friday, West Texas Intermediate on the New York Mercantile Exchange rose $1.87, or 3.1%, to close at $63.05 a barrel. The posted price was raised $1.75 to $59.50 a barrel. Price gains were offset by a rise in U.S. gasoline and diesel stocks, which offset record-high crude exports, which lowered Gulf Coast inventories by the most ever. Natural gas trended lower most of the holiday-shortened week, gaining less than a penny Friday to close at $2.130 per MCF. Rig count declines continue. The decline in the U.S., Texas, and Permian rig counts continued this week, according to oilfield services company Baker Hughes. The Permian Basin rig count fell by 2 to 403, while the Texas rig count dropped 1 rig, putting the state count also at 403. Texas still has more than half the nation's active rigs, and the Permian represents 60% of the oil drilling rigs in the nation. New Mexico also lost 1 rig, putting 104 rigs at work within state lines. The U.S. rig count dropped back below 800 rigs, dropping 9 to 796 rigs. That puts the national rig count at the lowest level since March 2017. The count has fallen 25% since the beginning of 2019. Eddy County, New Mexico, added 1 rig for 52, making it the most active county in the Permian Basin. Lee County, New Mexico, which lost 2 rigs, and Midland County, which remained unchanged, were second with 51 rigs each. Reeves County remained unchanged at 45 rigs, while Loving County added a rig for 37. Martin County was unchanged at 31 rigs, and Howard County lost 1 rig for 24. Ward County lost 2 rigs for 22, while Upton County was unchanged at 18 rigs, and Pecos County added a rig for 18 rigs at work within county lines. Culberson County was unchanged at 12 rigs. Andrews County added a rig for 10 rigs. The U.S. shale sector suffered through much of 2019 because of weaker crude oil prices, budget cutbacks, and job losses throughout the industry. However, the U.S. benchmark for crude oil is back above $62 per barrel for the first time since September. Despite record-high U.S. oil and gas production, the energy sector has struggled with lower oil prices, skeptical investors, and weakening global oil demand. With this week's decline, the oil rig count is down 58% from its peak of 1,609 in October 2014, before prices began their free fall during the last oil bust. Rigs today, however, are able to drill more wells and to deeper depths to produce more oil and gas, allowing the United States to produce record volumes of crude oil and natural gas. Bride's choice of groomsmen brings back painful memories. Dear Abby for Saturday. Dear Abby, I am a 37-year-old man who is getting married for the first time. My fiancé, Holly, and I went to middle school and high school together, but never really got to know each other until a few years ago. I love her more than words can describe, and I'm happy to be getting ready to spend my life with her. Growing up, I was socially awkward, partly due to having Asperger's, which made me a target for bullies. Holly and I are now choosing our wedding party. My sister will be one of her bridesmaids. Holly is an only child, so she doesn't have a brother who could be one of her groomsmen. She has expressed that she would like her cousin, Gerald, to be one of my groomsmen, so someone from her family is in our wedding party. The problem is, Gerald was my main tormentor from 8th grade, all through high school. At one point in 10th grade, his cruelty led to my attempting suicide. I carry the scar from the attempt on my right wrist. I understand that people change and mature as they grow older, and I'm okay with Gerald attending the wedding. But the idea of having him standing next to me on the biggest day of my life, along with my best friend and two closest cousins, triggers too many awful memories. How can I plead this to Holly without hurting her feelings or looking shallow and petty? Nervous groom-to-be. Dear groom-to-be, shallow and petty? The scar on your wrist is visible, but clearly there are others equally painful that are not. I don't think it would come across as either shallow or petty if you explained to your fiancé, exactly as you have explained it to me, why you prefer Gerald not to be at the altar with you on the most important day of your life. This is something Holly should have been made aware of before the two of you set a wedding date. Do it now. Dear Abby, I have been an alcoholic since I was 21. I was married for 19 years, and my drinking was at its worst toward the end. I was selfish toward my wife and my daughter. Since then, I have learned many hard lessons that could have been avoided if only I had never drunk. I have apologized to my ex-wife for my actions. I was never violent, but I embarrassed her and my daughter with behavior that I'm ashamed of. After our divorce, I made a few more mistakes and finally sought help. I'm in a Christian-based rehab program and have chosen to follow this path for the rest of my life. Over the last 6 months, I have sent texts and a few letters to my daughter, hoping for an acknowledgement or some dialogue, to no avail. Since being at rehab, I've written her about my feelings and some small talk, always ending my letter telling her she's the love of my heart and I miss her. Is there anything else I can do? Hoping and praying in Nashville. Dear Hoping, yes, there is one more thing you can do. Because she may consider your words nothing but lip service, make an attempt to visit her so she can see the change in you. Accept that damage has been done and you cannot alter the past. Continue living your life on the path you have chosen and pray that, with time, your daughter will recognize that you have turned your life around and let you back into hers. Obituaries and death notices from the MRT for Saturday. Faye Markham, 83, of Midland, passed away on Wednesday, January 1st, surrounded by her family. The family received friends Sunday, January 5th, at Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. on Monday, January 6th, at Midland Church of God. Burial will follow at Rest Haven North Cemetery. Faye was born on March 2, 1936, to Pearl and Albert Ruth in Colorado City, Texas. She married Buddy Markham. She is survived by two sons, Steve Markham and wife Kathy, and Mike Markham and wife Rachel, all of Midland, four granddaughters, one grandson, and 12 great-grandchildren. She is preceded in death by parents, brothers Virgil and Jimmy Ruth. In lieu of flowers, the family suggests memorials be donated to the Alzheimer's Association. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Judy Baxter, 62, of Midland, passed away Wednesday, January 1st. Funeral service will be Friday, January 10th at 10 a.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Chapel. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. She is survived by her father, Henry Hardknock, Jr., one sister, and two brothers. Julia Edith Drake, 89, of Midland, passed away Monday, December 30th at Manor Park. She was born May 5, 1930, in Midland, to the late Julia Potter and Herd Midkiff. The family received friends for visitation Sunday, January 5th, at Ellis Funeral Home. Funeral services will be held Monday, January 6th, at 2 p.m., at Cotton Flat Baptist Church, with Pastor Rick Holliman officiating. Burial will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Please visit ellisfunerals.com to leave online condolences. Martin Pardo Bustamante, 49, passed away January 2nd. Visitation was held Friday, January 3rd, at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Burial will be held at a later date. Survivors include his wife, Maria Pardo, sons Eduardo Hernandez, Mario Hernandez, three sisters, and one brother. Virginia Patricia Ginger Corey, 85, of Midland, passed away Tuesday, December 31st, at her residence. She was born October 23, 1934, in Boston, Massachusetts, to the late Ruth A. Vader and Alfred F. Cataldo. No services are scheduled at this time.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Sunday, January 5th, 2020. Section E, Culture. Art meets artificial intelligence. Austin artists explore new meaning in data, by Ho-Jun Choi of the Austin American Statesman. Walking into Julia Morton's art gallery in Austin is, in a word, trippy. The cozy space is full of otherworldly art filled with shapes, scratches, and swirls. Some of the works are still images, while others are videos. At first glance, none of it seems to make any kind of sense. People freeze. They're mesmerized. They literally won't move, Morton said. It's like they have to look, and from what I've been told, get their bearings. Morton's work is part of a budding art form, one that uses artificial intelligence, AI, to generate images and visuals. Dubbed generative art, the works are created through non-human systems, such as computers. Artists have used algorithms and computers to generate art as early as the 1950s. University of Texas art history professor Taylor Bradley said the infusion of AI into the generative art genre is a relatively new development. Across the country, there are shows going up all the time about digital art, AI-generated art, smart technologies, and what have you, she said. I think there is plenty of acceptance and excitement over this new medium. Despite its recent arrival on the scene, Bradley said the practice of using AI to create art reminds her of a period in art history when artisans and craftsmen used to hone their various skills to create beautiful vases and furniture. I think artists have always been engineers who are inventing, innovating, and pushing the limits of technology, she said. Before Morton opened her East 6th Street gallery, named the Generative Art Project, she was entrenched in the world of fashion. She has also worked as an art columnist in New York. Morton said the new brand of AI-powered generative art forces people to look inward for meaning rather than using external context. For the first time in my life, in a very overarching way, this work is arousing our self-awareness of our animalistic nature, Morton said. Many of the artists whose works are featured in the gallery will first collect data sets found in the real world. Then, through the use of artificial intelligence, AI, artists find patterns in data sets that can be incorporated into their work through visualization tools. Because the data is grounded in reality, Morton said, people gain a sense of familiarity even in generative art that looks completely abstract. You get a feeling that you're in the presence of a living, real thing, Morton said, and that changes both how you experience the work as well as how you try to understand it. Morton's husband, James Pricer, is a local artist who creates art with the help of artificial intelligence. For one of his works, Pricer used data that he collected from a person's life, including their blood pressure, heart rate, and information. Though his art is largely enabled by the analysis powered by artificial intelligence, Pricer says the final part of his process depends on something much more human. What tells me that I'm finished is when I have a very strong emotional reaction, he said. Pricer, who has a background in data science, says he had long wanted to find a way to communicate to others the meaning he found in numbers. Traditionally, in the art world, you either had representational art or abstract art. Just like bridging tech and art, I thought if I could bridge representation and abstraction, that would make it possible for me to communicate what I see and feel in the data. And it's turning out to be true, Pricer said. Joao Beira is the founder of Datagramma Visuals, a company based in Austin that organizes performances and exhibitions using AI-generated art. Beira came to the United States from his native Portugal about 10 years ago to pursue a doctoral degree in digital media at the University of Texas at Austin. I realized that even though Austin is in touch with the musical experience, visually there was not really much going on in terms of bringing new ideas and doing things outside the norm, he said. Beira said the lack of an existing community is not necessarily a hindrance. Rather, he said it presents more of a blank canvas that he and other generative artists can fill. Austin might not be the first city you think about when you think about this technology, but the fact that the scene does not yet exist helps us build a foundation to build something here, Beira said. He said he finds meaning in generative art that is inspired by nature. You can find, for example, how trees grow and how they generate branches, or how the scales of a fish are organized, he said. You can actually replicate these different patterns and algorithms, and you can generate them in real time. Beira uses different programs to create his works, such as Deep Dream, an artificial intelligence-enabled software created by Google engineer Alexander Mordvintsev that studies patterns in images and generates its own shapes and colors based on the patterns that it has identified. Beira's company also uses software created by an Austin-based company called Synesthesia Live to create visualizations at live music performances. None of the visuals are pre-programmed by Beira to look a specific way. The added element of unpredictability, he said, is what makes AI-generated art exciting for him. Beira said he hopes his art can help people gain a better understanding of human consciousness and, in the process, themselves. It's not so much me being the creator and the ideas I have in my head, Beira said. It's more about me being an architect, pulling all these things together and seeing where it takes me, because it's completely unpredictable how the machine learns to see the world, just like a child when it first starts to look around the world and begins making the notion of their own world. Ector County Sheriff's Office receives cards from Cards for Kids. The Ector County Sheriff's Office received a box of holiday cards from Cards for Kids, a group that sends cards during the holiday season to children and communities affected by mass shootings. The group began sending cards after 58 people were killed in a shooting in Las Vegas, according to a letter shared by ECSO. This year, residents from 26 states and Canada sent in cards to be shared with affected communities, the letter states. "We hope that this brings a smile to your face and to your heart," wrote Jackie Schildkraut of Cards for Kids, "wishing you nothing but happiness, love, and laughter this holiday season." ECSO posted a video to their Facebook page of them opening the box of cards. Sheriff Mike Griffiths said in the video it was the most cards he'd seen in his life. "We've had kind of a rough year this year," Griffiths said in the video. "We're going to make 2020 a better year." Mason has a population of characters. By Tumbleweed Smith. Mason is a hill country town of 2,500 residents with a courthouse square that's hard to maneuver. It has an extremely dense population of characters. Perhaps that's what makes the town so interesting. You can hardly go there without having some type of unique experience. One of my favorite eating places is Crockett Keller's Guns and Grub restaurant on the square near the Odeon Theater. One side of his building is the restaurant. The other half is his gun store. Crockett has some of the best seafood I've ever eaten. That's right, seafood in Mason. Crockett spends 3 days getting his oysters ready. I spoke at the library in Mason recently and did a couple of interviews while I was in town. One was with Ethan West, a barber who walked the 2,200-mile Appalachian Trail. Another was with Tony Plutino, a river guide who knows about the best places in Texas to go canoeing. I also interviewed Jan Appleby, who heads up the group restoring the elegant Sequist House, one of the first mansions in the Hill Country. It was built in the 1880s and has 22 rooms and 15 fireplaces. One of my early radio programs featured Mason County resident Fred Gibson, the author of Old Yeller. That set a high standard for future interviews in Mason. Mason is known as the gem of the Hill Country, maybe because topaz is found in the area. It also has an interesting number of people interested in making wine. The Bat Cave, just out of town, attracts visitors and scientists who study the nighttime scavengers. Fort Mason has created interest among people who research pioneer days. The city is a welcoming community and has many transplants from Austin and other places. They quickly assimilate and find things to do, working with the library, museum, chamber, or other organizations. The list of characters I've interviewed in or near Mason includes Bill O'Banion, who hit a golf ball 30 miles from Mason to another nearby town. Took him several strokes. Sculptor Bill Worrell lives on the Llano River south of Mason, as does Laura Lewis, an artist who does murals in office buildings for Fortune 500 companies. Spider Johnson is an accomplished saw player. Gene Zetch is well known for his wood carvings. Tom Hadley set high standards as a professional rodeo announcer. Tommy Splitgarber acted in some Hollywood movies. Ray Carrington taught fly fishing. I've done reports on Mason's courthouse clock, the Odeon Theater, where the world premiere of Old Yeller took place, the city's high number of tennis players, its historic homes, knife makers, store owners, photographers, entertainers, historians, storytellers, cowboys, and hunters. I interviewed one man long ago who took his pet llama for a walk around the courthouse square every evening. It just seemed like the normal thing to do. One man had a pet crow. Parsley is more than a garnish. By Barbara Porsche of Permian Basin Master Gardeners. Now is a good time to get a head start on an herb garden at your house. You should be able to find parsley seeds or maybe transplants at the nurseries or box stores. Parsley is like a vitamin pill. It is rich in vitamins A, B, C, and is a good source of calcium, niacin, potassium, and magnesium. An added bonus is that it deodorizes your breath, especially after eating garlic or onions. If you get some seeds, now is an excellent time to sprinkle them in your garden or any sunny spot in a flower bed. With the recent rain and hopefully some more soon, all the seeds that fell in my garden have suddenly sprouted. That is an added benefit. Parsley reseeds easily. At least the flat leaf variety does. The curly leaf variety is not so prolific, but be sure to plant enough for the caterpillars and butterflies. They love it. Parsley is a true biennial. It grows leaves the first year, then blooms and reseeds the second year, so you can see that I hardly ever have a time when I cannot go out and pick some for cooking. If you have a lot or purchase some at a store, you can put it in a glass of water like a bouquet of flowers, and it will last several days there or in the fridge. There are many uses for parsley besides decorating a plate. It can be used in almost any type of vegetable dish. New potatoes tossed with chopped parsley is a traditional Easter dish at my house. It can be chopped and tossed with cooked rice. Almost any pesto recipe has parsley in the list of ingredients. A big handful of fresh leaves adds a crisp flavor to a regular green salad. The stems are more flavorful and can be added to soups, stews, and stuffings. When you get a parsley decoration on your dinner plate at a fancy restaurant, don't leave it there. Eat it. If you have questions about growing parsley, call the AgriLife office in Midland at 686-4700 for more information. Wild About Texas. Sandhill cranes usually are heard before they are seen. By Michael Price. To the budding Texas naturalist, it would seem as though the winter months do not afford ample opportunities to view wildlife because of seasonal inactivity. However, this is not the case, especially when the goal is to view wildlife that occupies this area for the few brief weeks of what we call winter. One of these wildlife viewings is the spectacular sandhill crane. Although the primary range of the sandhill crane is in the northern portions of this continent during the summer months, where the species comes from, when the seasons there begin to change to the brutally cold winter, it makes its home in the temperate climates of the southern continental United States, including the western two-thirds of Texas. As the crane makes its migratory journey to and from its winter home, it flies communally, rarely if ever venturing far on its own. Often they will fly in a V formation, although occasionally they will fly in a straight line. Regardless of the formation they fly in, they will often be heard before they are seen, as they have a tendency to sound off in a nasally trumpet-like song that can be heard from as far off as a mile away. This species of crane is large and can achieve body lengths of up to 4 feet and wingspans that can approach a whopping 6 feet. At first sight, it seems to have an almost gangly appearance. This stately look is due to the long legs and neck, as well as the large, straight bill. This almost comical look is exaggerated when this animal takes flight, as it takes several steps with its long legs as it gains enough momentum to take to the air. In flight, the downstroke of the wings is very slow and methodical, while the upstroke is rapid and jerky. Distinguishing characteristics of this bird as an adult include the bright red crown of the head, white chin and cheeks, light gray body and wings, and the aforementioned long neck and legs. Sandhill cranes are omnivorous, meaning that its diet consists of plants as well as animals, such as fish, frogs, crustaceans, and insects. It utilizes its long legs to walk great distances through the shallow water of marshes and playas to search for food. It also roosts communally in these areas, typically standing upright through the night. While on its winter retreat, the males, which are larger than the females, will attempt to court its prospective mate by a noisy and conspicuous dance that consists of leaping up to 8 feet into the air while calling loudly and beating its wings. If the female is interested in mating, then she will join in with the male in this dancing display. After such breeding, the pair remains monogamous and mates for life, and then both return to their summer homes. Upon arrival, both sexes will prepare the nest for the two eggs, which are incubated by both parents for approximately 30 days. The young will take their first flight at about 2 months of age. As with many large birds, it was wantonly killed during the earlier parts of the last century. However, habitat loss from agricultural use has been the largest conservational concern to scientists, but its numbers seem to be stable and even increasing. The sandhill crane can be quite common in areas of the panhandle, with large groups congregating in playas south of Lubbock, as well as in portions of the northern Edwards Plateau, with other communal sites occurring near the town of Robert Lee. Dear Abby, Family Pariah finds safety but not security. Dear Abby, I have dysfunctional parents. For the sake of my sanity, I made the decision to remove them from my life. They have retaliated by spreading lies to immediate and extended family. I was supposed to get an apartment with my father to help him now that he is aging. However, he became violent and threatened to kill me. I moved away and am physically safe now. My problem is I'm now completely alone and a pariah on both sides of my family. These lodgings are temporary. I'm afraid they will fall through once family finds out where I am and poisons this very distant relative against me. How am I supposed to survive this? I have a job, but big deal if I have nothing to live for and no purpose. Anonymous escapee. Dear escapee, your chances of having a more permanent roof over your head will be better if you tell this relative everything you have told me before someone else gets to him or her. Your father appears to have serious mental problems you are not equipped to deal with, which may become apparent in the near future when he acts out against someone else. You made the right choice. Your family members may be angry because they are now the ones who have to take care of him, which is why they have started the smear campaign. People survive situations like yours by performing their jobs well enough to excel and making new friends along the way. It's called creating a family of choice. Most of the individuals who do it thrive because the relationships are healthy ones. You have much to live for and many happy times ahead, so please remember that and concentrate on a future filled with possibilities. If you do, it is what you will achieve. Dear Abby, my husband and I have been together for 15 years, married for 6. We have the best relationship. Everybody tells us how great we are together. We don't fight, and we support each other 100% with everything. While my husband isn't overweight, he does go back and forth from going to the gym to work out and eating healthy to stopping and putting the weight right back on. I honestly couldn't care less about the number on his scale. The problem is, he's a horrible snorer. It's awful. I usually end up moving to the couch in the middle of the night to get some sleep. I have tried earplugs, headphones, you name it. He has tried the strips, the sprays, mouth guards, been to the doctor, everything. He always feels bad when he wakes up and finds me out of the bed. I've told him that it doesn't make me mad. I just get annoyed when I have to get up and go. The only thing that seems to make a difference is when he loses weight. How do I tell him that if he lost some weight, he would snore less? I don't want to hurt his feelings. Sleeping Badly in Ohio. Dear Sleeping Badly, if you have observed that your husband snores less when his weight is down, tell him. It isn't hurtful. It would be helpful. You say he's been to see his doctor. Ask if he's been checked for sleep apnea. If there are long pauses between a sleeping person's breaths or gasping. It could be a symptom of sleep apnea, a condition that can be life-threatening. A diagnosis could be a lifesaver. Hints from Heloise. Use grapefruit spoon to scoop out pepper seeds. Dear Heloise, I always had a problem when I cleaned peppers. I never could get all the seeds out. I seemed to work forever to get them all out, but always had a lot left. I don't know how I found this out, but now I use a grapefruit spoon, and it works like a charm. Just scrape the inside of the pepper, and out they come. Big D in Ohio. A New Year's Cleaning. Dear Heloise, with a new year comes the desire to clean out my pantry in the kitchen. It's a great time to get rid of those foods that are out of date or those that have been invaded by insects, usually weevils. I use a cup of bleach to a gallon of water to wash down the shelves. Then I dry them and return the food to the pantry. Everything is organized and clean for the new year. Maisie J., Klamath Falls, Oregon. Maisie, that's a great idea. To all my readers, I wish for you a happy and healthy 2020. Heloise. Sweet Cement. Dear Heloise, after years of having my brown sugar turn into cement once it was opened, I found a solution. I sealed it in a vacuum sealer, and voila, even after a month or two, it is still soft. I thought others might find this helpful. Pat C., Bessemer, Alabama. Cherry Surprise. Dear Heloise, please reprint your Cherry Surprise recipe. I haven't made it in a long time and have forgotten how, but it was the special request of my son who is coming home on leave from the military. Carrie in Mississippi. Carrie, anything for our men and women in uniform. You'll need to cream together 2 sticks of butter or margarine and 2 cups sugar. Beat 3 eggs and add into the butter-sugar mixture. Mix in 1 teaspoon vanilla extract, 2 teaspoons almond extract, and 1 pint sour cream. Then add 3 cups flour, 1 teaspoon baking soda, and 1/2 teaspoon salt. Mix to blend. Last, stir in 1 cup chopped maraschino cherries and 1 1/2 cups chopped nuts. Bake in a greased and floured tube pan at 325 degrees Fahrenheit for about 1 to 1.5 hours. When the cake has cooled, sprinkle with powdered sugar. FYI, when using powdered cake mix, put the water in the bowl first, then the dry mix. This helps prevent powder pockets at the bottom of the bowl. Heloise. Handy Hints. Dear readers, here are a few handy hints. Microwave a lemon for 12 to 14 seconds and you'll increase the juice it produces. Use latex gloves to open stubborn jar lids. Instead of using toothpicks for closing stuffed pork chops or chicken breasts, try raw spaghetti. It's edible. Heloise.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Sunday, January 5th, 2020. This is Section A. The headline reads, Midland Development Corporation Close to Second Spaceport Occupant, by Stuart Doreen. Endeavor Energy CEO Autry Stevens is among officials at Florida-based satellite company looking to come to Midland's spaceport. The Midland Development Corporation is on the verge of filling the second empty building at the Spaceport Business Park. The MDC board will vote Monday to allow its executive director to negotiate and execute an economic development agreement with Kepler Aerospace Limited, which, according to its website, quote, is developing both highly efficient and economically viable satellite delivery systems, unquote. MDC Chief Operating Officer Sarah Harris told the Reporter Telegram that the sublease agreement is in final review with Kepler Aerospace's legal team. The agreement calls for Kepler to occupy the empty 17,000-square-foot building, once occupied by Orbital Outfitters, at the business park. Harris said the deal does not include a cash incentive, but that if Kepler meets contractually obligated milestones, it will receive lease abatements for 3 years. the deal is almost identical to the MDC's deal with Avalon Space Technology and Science made late in 2018, she said. AST, which designs and manufactures miniature satellites, took over the hangar once occupied by X-Corp Aerospace. The company has received rent abatements for reaching its negotiated goals. Harris said the agreement with Kepler calls for the company to create at least 20 new jobs, $2 million in annual payroll, and have $80 million in personal property investment by its third year. Those are conservative estimates, Harris said. That means Midland Spaceport, which has been a hot-button issue politically after failed deals with X-Corp and Orbital, could be home to two satellite companies that between them promise at least 190 full-time jobs, $15 million in payroll, and $94.25 million in capital improvements, personal property, and inventory investment at the property. While AST has moved its corporate headquarters to Midland, Kepler Aerospace will continue to have its headquarters at Cape Canaveral, Florida, Harris said. Harris said Midland Spaceport and its location at a commercial airport are factors in Kepler's interest in Midland. Kepler's website states that it has several technologies in the fields of microwave, propulsion, and energy, and has recently filed for 8 trademarks in both the flight and defense use categories. The company is currently developing and commercializing many of these technologies, such as its proprietary plasma or high-energy electrical power, technology to generate propulsion, thrust, lift, and flight, Kepler's website states. The company has also developed several other proprietary propulsion, energy, and microwave burst technologies, can be used in several configurations, and are currently being developed by the company as technologies to be marketed to the military and defense industries. Kepler officials include Buzz Aldrin, a spokesman, government liaison, and advisor, and Midlander Autry C. Stevens, chief executive officer at Endeavor Energy Resources. Stevens is listed as an advisory board member and local government liaison. The Midland Development Corporation board will vote on the agreement at its meeting set for 10 a.m. Monday at the basement conference room at City Hall. This article is entitled Court Date Has Not Been Set on MISD Bond by Brandy Addison. The aftermath of Midland ISD's bond recount is now in its 7th week. After the November general election revealed the $569 million school bond failed by 25 votes, the pro-bond committee, We Choose Our Future, petitioned for a recount of the ballots. The recount, which took place November 22nd and 23rd, flipped the outcome, and the bond passed by 11 votes. However, there was an 820-vote discrepancy between the paper ballots counted manually during the recount and the electronic votes tabulated during the general election on November 5th and November 12th. Though hundreds of votes unaccounted for, the election results were certified on November 26th. The school board approved the outcome 6-0, making it the final election outcome. Board President Rick Davis was not at that meeting. The investigation into the election began soon after. December 2nd. Ballot boxes are opened. Tally sheets are copied. Representatives from We Choose Our Future and Better Bond for Midland, the committee that opposed the bond, witnessed the opening of the electronic machines. A single ballot was found in the bottom of one machine. Additionally, representatives were asked to witness copying of tally sheets as part of an investigation process. This part of the process was delayed because the elections office printer ran out of ink. December 4th, copying of tally sheets is completed. The copying of tally sheets was completed the afternoon of December 4th, after a new cartridge was delivered by the election office's vendor. The tally sheets were what each representative had written on during the recount process. County Attorney Russell Malm said the copying process was to ensure the results of the sheets matched with the official results from the recount. December 6th, elections office petitions for a court order to open ballot boxes. Malm said the elections office filed a petition with the district court asking permission to open sealed ballot boxes. This is required by law, he said. December 9th. Elections office discovers possible source of discrepancy. Malm said he believes the discrepancy was from early voting at the elections office, based on the differences showing in the sign-in sheets and the tallies, though he was not certain if the votes existed or if they had been duplicated by the electronic machines. December 12th. Ballot totals are counted. A ballot count began at 9 a.m. The ballots were supposed to be counted manually and electronically. However, the electronic machine could not count only the ballot totals, but would also tabulate for or against, which did not comply with the petition. Counting teams counted only the ballots that were cast during early voting at the elections office. The discrepancy widened to 840 votes. However, a new box was discovered. It was uncertain if the box was from the November 5th election or 2018. December 13th, county attorney petitions for a court order to open new ballot box and count the ballots from all other ballot boxes. Malm find a court order to open a new ballot box. If it was from this election, the total number would be counted. Counting teams would also tally the number of ballots in each box that was not counted December 12th. December 16th, new ballot box is open and found to be from this election. The new ballot box was opened, and it was discovered to be from this year's early voting at the elections office. There were 836 ballots in this box. It was not officially confirmed that these ballots account for the discrepancy. The ballot box was not recorded in the chain of custody reports. December 16th. We choose our future co-chairs, filed to contest the election. As a result of the newly discovered box, we choose our future co-chairs, Christine Foreman and Dave Joyner, filed an election contest. They requested that the ballots from the new box be included in a new manual recount to ensure all voters get an accurate tally of all votes cast in the bond election. December 19th. Davis answers to those who filed to contest. The school board president granted the examination of the secured ballots. The manual count was set for 9 a.m. January 6th. December 20th. Elections Commission meets to discuss election administrators' employment. Midland County's Elections Commission held a meeting at the annex to discuss the employment status of election administrator Deborah Land. Tax assessor collector Karen Hood made a motion to terminate her from her position. It failed for lack of a second. Land will continue to serve as the election administrator. December 20th. Better Bond for Midland representatives filed an intervention to the election contest. Brandon Hodges, Thomas Wolfmuller, Kenya K. Murchison, and James Beecham filed a petition to intervene in the election contest. They requested that a new election be ordered and the outcome be voided. Lawyer Joe Nixon said these votes should not be considered legal because there was an error with the chain of custody. December 30th. Davis answers those who intervened. Because there was an intervention, a manual recount can no longer take place until it is ordered in a court hearing. Therefore, the recount set for January 6th was canceled. The court hearing has not been scheduled. In opposition to what the interveners believe, Davis denied that the true outcome of the original election cannot be legally ascertained. He asked that the court order a manual recount and not void the election outcome. In his answer, Davis wrote, "Contestee accordingly believes that this court can ascertain the true outcome of MISD's bond election through a manual count of all the ballots, including the recently discovered ballots, to ensure that all legal ballots cast in the election are counted. Upon information and belief, to the extent there is any question as to the legality of the newly discovered ballots or any other ballots, any such questions can be resolved by accessing the digital copies of such ballots that are to reside in the voting machines. A manual recount of all ballots would also have the potential benefit of demonstrating that the voting machines correctly tallied all ballots, which, if so proven, would help restore confidence in them for this and future elections. This article is entitled Morales Leaves with Record of Accomplishment by Stuart Doreen. The narrative during a contentious city council campaign season was that not much had been accomplished during the last 6 years and that the current city leadership stood in the way of progress. Midland City Councilman Scott Dufford sees it differently and reminded the Reporter-Telegram that when the book is written on the outgoing council, Midland will see an unrivaled series of accomplishments, which include funding Northeast Water System improvements. The $50 million investment will allow for the infrastructure to build up to 10,000 homes in Northeast Midland. Funding a new animal shelter. This is an expected $11 million investment. The $100 million road bond. The 5-year program will provide improvements on 26 different streets. The bond was passed overwhelmingly by Midland voters. Increasing money spent annually on road maintenance from less than $1 million to more than $12 million. The reconstruction of Dennis the Menace Park. This public-private venture resurrected one of the community's favorite parks. The transformation of Doug Russell and Washington Aquatic Centers from aged swimming pools to 21st-century water parks. The building of a new municipal courthouse. $8 million in upgrades to the radio system being used by first responders. The public-private partnership between the city and Pioneer Natural Resources. The agreement is expected to provide the city with $110 million for improvements to an aging water treatment facility and $2.5 million annually for reclaimed wastewater. The funding or building of multiple fire stations, including 10, 6, and 5. The largest raise for police officers, according to Dufford. City leaders hope increased wages will help in recruitment and retainment. The building of the $43 million Bush Convention Center. The public-private partnership resulting in a $17 million downtown park. Dufford believes Centennial Park will be, quote, the talk of West Texas for sure, unquote. The approval of an agreement that provides nearly $40 million in incentives, abatements, and other payments to build a 4-star hotel and parking garage downtown. Dufford, the Dean of Midland Council members, said it's an impressive list that likely doesn't happen without the leadership of Mayor Jerry Morales. I'm not sure that any mayor in the last 20 years has accomplished more, Dufford said matter-of-factly. Dufford has served during the entire terms of Mike Cannon, Wes Perry, and Morales. Heading into the 2013 election, he said about the mayor's seat, it, quote, is not that big of a position. If it was, I would have run for mayor, unquote. A hectic 6 years later, Dufford has done a political 180, and the District 1 representative said he went from having his doubts about Morales to never seeing anyone work harder and never seeing anyone grow into the position more than Morales. He's one of the most decent individuals I think I've ever worked with, Dufford said. And I think that at the end of the day, Midland couldn't have hoped for a better person to be elected mayor 6 years ago. A commitment to the city. In 2013, Morales dominated a 5-person race for the mayor's seat. Life changed as he knew it for a position that pays $75 a month. Morales told the Reporter-Telegram that the commitment required to lead one of the fastest-growing cities in the nation impacted his life and his restaurant business. Morales is the owner of Gerardo's Casita on North Big Spring Street. During the last 6 years, he also opened Mulberry Cafe, located at Wadley Avenue and Garfield Street, and a second Mulberry Cafe located downtown. Morales said that during his time as mayor, and before that as at-large councilman, he got used to his customers providing their thoughts on council decisions. If they're going to come in and spend $20 on some enchiladas, they're going to get your attention and talk about issues sometimes, Morales said last week. He said business in general can have its swings, just like the economy inside the city he leads. But instead of the price of oil being a driver during the last 6 years, Morales said he noticed people stayed away from Mulberry Cafe until controversial votes were completed and the politics in Midland settled down. Girardo's had built a steady clientele in its 40-something years, he said. We noticed that when the dust settles, things seem to pick up again, Morales said. Service matters to Morales, something that likely comes from being in the restaurant business. He feels 2% unemployment as much as the next business owner. It is not uncommon for the veteran restaurateur to be working in the kitchen to make sure customers get their food in a timely manner. Not every restaurateur serves as president of the Texas Restaurant Association. Morales led the group in 2014, the first year he was mayor. Commitment to the city impacted his home life, Morales said. During a political postmortem with the Reporter Telegram, he volunteered that during the last 6 years he and his wife Meredith divorced. He said his marriage suffered because of the amount of time he dedicated to his professional and political lives. While under a tremendous spotlight as one of Midland's most public figures, Morales said he always attempted to keep his personal and political issues separate. It's about the issues in this city and what you elected me to do, Morales said. Not an easy time to be mayor. A population explosion in Midland this past decade left the city, its infrastructure, its deteriorating roads, and its culture susceptible to tens of thousands of new Midlanders. Anyone who has attended council meetings will hear a council member blame previous councils for their lack of action in a particular area. It seems those mentions were more common by council during Morales' time in office. The growth has shown where Midland, and by extension its leaders, was lacking. Lack of housing. Just more than a month's supply in 2019 when a balanced market has between 6 and 9 months. Lack of road and water sewer infrastructure impacted the ability to construct homes. The lack of available job candidates impacted fire and police department rosters. The lack of resources and workforce hindered the city's ability to stay out in front of the issues. It's just like the retail in our city. Our city staff was short-handed, Morales said, and it required the council to work more hours than usual. Yeah, I've had past mayors come up to me and say, you know, we were busy when we were mayor, but I don't know how you're doing because you're 4 times busier than we ever were. I wanted to make sure that residents were given that service that I do every day in the restaurant, and that requires a lot of attention. A lot of times we're shorthanded, picking up trash, and our streets were in disrepair. So, I mean, those emails were coming in like the floodgates were open. It was tough sometimes. The mayor during the last 6 years also dealt with a council that included such headstrong and sometimes outspoken figures like Dufford, former District 4 Representative J. Ross Lacey, former District 2 Representative John B. Love III, former District 1 Representative Jeff Sparks, and at-large Councilman Spencer Robnett. Morales said he knew there were doubts among those on the council if, quote, Jerry could do this, unquote. However, he said he relied on the leadership skills developed in the restaurant business to make sure he played to their strengths. Jerry's leadership skills proved to not only be the key to his election, but the driving force of his success as mayor of Midland, Midland Development Corporation Chairman Brent Hilliard wrote in an op-ed. Each council member, including soon-to-be former District 3 Representative Sharla Hotchkiss, were given responsibilities for certain departments, commissioners, and committees. I let it known what my vision was going to be to get accomplished, Morales said, and it's going to take every one of us to move this city forward. Moving forward. The next Midland City Council, new Mayor Patrick Payton, new District 2 Representative to be determined on January 28th, new District 3 Representative Jack Ladd Jr., and new District 4 Representative Lori Blong, likely will benefit from the past council's work to create new fees for stormwater drainage and new development, so-called impact fees. The next council will have new zoning ordinances that city leaders said will bring efficiencies. The new council members said during their campaigns that these efficiencies were needed. The new council and city moving forward will benefit from Morales' decision to recruit Hilliard to bring stability to the Midland Development Corporation. Under Hilliard's leadership, the MDC's focus has mainly been on infrastructure, workforce, health care, and education. The new council also comes into place as another MDC initiative, Priority Midland, takes its next steps. Priority Midland was created for the taxing entities to work together to help the community deal with the growth taking place. Peyton, during his campaign, called for the city to determine its values to help create its priorities moving forward. Midland is in a much better place today than when Jerry took office, Hilliard said. The decisions made by Jerry and the council members over the last 6 years are long-lasting. Jerry, the city council, and city staff have set into place a 10-year growth plan which is flexible, providing future leaders a pathway forward and which did not exist when Jerry took office. This is a testimony to Jerry's leadership and to the countless others that have participated in this planning effort. Hands down, this council will go down in history as one of the best councils Midland has ever known. The future for Morales will become less hectic about the time Peyton takes the oath of office on January 13th. The number of people requesting Morales' time for a mayoral appearance or to bend his ear about what they like or don't like about the city decreases dramatically. Morales, 54, said another restaurant could be in the works, and he plans to remain heavily invested in the Texas Restaurant Association. Politically, he'd like to serve on a state commission and be active in the Republican Party, maybe as a delegate. He knows that in about a week he will have the time to think about what's next. For the last 6 years, time hasn't exactly been in abundance. There's been too much to do.
That's the end of the first hour of the Midland Reporter Telegram in Odessa American. We'll begin our second hour right after we take a look at weather.